and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and shine a light on the path ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems together rather than just defend positions. And one of the great tools we have for perspective, for enlightenment, and for thinking outside the box is humor, laughter, what Swami Beyondananda calls cosmic comic consciousness. As a professional comedian for the past 30 or so years, I've always been a pretty big proponent of the healing power of laughter. And right now, I'm finding that it's more important than ever to use levity to defy gravity in these unfunny times. As Jim Morrison of The Doors said more than 50 years ago, strange days have found us. Consider, what is the state of satire when reality is more perversely paradoxical than any comedy routine? Or what happens when much of comedy censorship comes from the left? Or what's funny in a world that has become insanely serious? Well, to address these sticky, icky questions on this week's show, I've invited two of my favorite cosmic comic cohorts, Alicia Dattner and Brian Norell, to join us, hopefully to make us laugh and certainly make us think and reflect. So in segment one, we're going to talk to Alicia first. Alicia Dattner is a wise gal who began as a stand-up comic and has since done several successful one-woman shows. And, of course, being one woman makes her perfectly qualified for that. Her shows include, you like that, her shows include One Life Stand, The Oi of Sex, and Eat, Pray, and Laugh. She is voted the best comedian in both the San Francisco Weekly and San Francisco Bay Guardian Readers polls. She's also creator of the Spiritual Comedy Festival, and she teaches highly acclaimed storytelling workshops under the banner Solo Showdown. She's a great teacher, I know. Alicia's also made the bold statement that Comedy Club is sacred space where anything goes. So welcome, Alicia.
Thanks, Steve. Wow. I don't know if I can follow my own intro.
Well, you're going to have to, because there's nobody else who could live up to any of that. So let's start with the provocative statement that you made to me a few years ago, that the Comedy Club is sacred space. What do you mean by that? And what are the implications?
Well, I imagine that at the time what I meant was there are very few places in the world where you can really tell the truth and you can say anything you think and anything you feel and anything you believe. And if you say it in a funny way, you can get away with it. I think of the court jesters and the people who wrote plays for the kings, and if they had not been joking, they would have had their heads cut off. So I feel like the Comedy Club is really one of the last places where you can speak your truth, whatever that is, and not get your head cut off. And you all go, I was just joking. I was kidding. I was talking about some other guy.
Well, you know, it's interesting that when a comedian says, "I died," that would be having your head cut off would certainly be equivalent to that.
Very true.
So, I didn't mean to interrupt
because
you.
That's pretty much it. I think the club is a sacred space, and I think it's important that we keep that. I don't always. I think comedians don't always treat it as a sacred space. I think.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, when you walk into like a temple or you walk into a Hindu temple, you bow and you touch the stair and you touch it to your heart, or if you walk into a synagogue, you touch the thing, you walk into the church, you cross your, you know, you make the sign of the cross. to me, there are like some sacred things around telling the truth and being aligned, that when we walk into a comedy club, I guess my wish would be that we treat audiences and we treat our material as if we are doing a holy job in service of something higher, in service of the good of all people.
It's interesting that when you said the comedy club is sacred space, I thought of something that the Native American teacher Brooke Medicine Eagle told me many years ago, and she was talking about a Native American festival on the square in Santa Fe. And standing there was this very, very elegant, older Native American woman, just totally venerated, very respected. She's dressed to the nines and the fringes and turquoise and so on. And out in the streets, out in the gutter, are the Heyoki, who are the Native American clowns. Mm. And they're smashing watermelons, right? And at some point, one of the clowns who's been smashing watermelons takes all of this watermelon debris and juice, and he smears it all over this woman. And there's a moment of just gasping, and finally she just breaks out in laughter, because in that culture, the clown is sacred. The joker is wild. That nothing trumps the power of comedy to deconstruct our reality. And so, when I've heard that story, I've always considered that part of the job that comedians have are to work with weapons of mass deconstruction, where ideas are destroyed and people are left standing. So, in terms of this sacred space.
That's exactly what I meant. When I said it those years ago, it's just basically what you said.
You put the words right into my mouth. Well, now if everything goes in a certain regard in a sacred space, just like, you know, back in the old days, in medieval times, there were certain festival days where everything was turned upside down, everything was turned inside out and on its head. So given the political correctness which has instituted itself in a place where both Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock have declined to perform or present at campuses anymore because they don't want to be constricted by this political correctness. In the light of political correctness and in the light of the Me Too movement, how is all of that sitting with you as a comedian who's doing material about yourself, about sexuality, about embarrassing things, and so on? Is there a new line for you?
For me, I don't think there's a new line. I mean, to me, comedy so I would declare the club sacred space. I also would declare it toxic space. You know, I think for a long time, it has been really toxic. There have been a lot of, I mean, if you just look at the numbers of how many female comedians there are to how many male comedians there are, it's not hard to wonder, you know, that the club is where people come from. And that if people, there's not an equal number of women coming through the club than the men, then there's something up. So, you know, in terms of political correctness, I feel like I don't think I've got, I think my edginess tends not to encroach on the political debates. I'm a woman, so people like women on stage now, although it's still up for debate when you actually go into a club. And I am, I mean, I think I might talk about edgy things in the realm of sexuality or politics still kind of fit inside the bounds of what most political correctness is up to now. So for me, it hasn't really affected me. I've pushed the bounds kind of on all sides and yet not in a really intense way. I think it's affected a lot of people who maybe it would be helpful for them to think more clearly what they're up to and what they're going for and what their audiences are wanting. So, I mean, I really think there are two sides to this debate that are actually both very important and important to be heard. I think the Me Too movement has been really important for what's happening, you know, what's been happening for the past 2,000 years. And I also think people should still be able to speak their truth. So it's a balance.
Have you found, you know, since the election of 2016, that there's something different about comedy? There's something different about how you've been doing comedy, about the responses that you've gotten to your shows and programs?
You know, the funniest thing is people say, "Wow, it must be a really good time for you." That's the difference. People go, "Wow, you must be doing really well right now." That's kind of the main thing I've noticed. People give lip service more, I think, to like, "Oh, female comedy, that's a thing now." But I think we have such ingrained, such deep feelings about seeing a woman on stage and thinking whether they're funny or not, like that I don't think that's changing as rapidly as our assessment of what should be, you know, like our assessment of how things should be culturally. I certainly, there are certain political things I talk. I mean, I certainly have a couple Trump jokes and jokes about politics that I feel pretty, it's pretty easy for me to make. I don't think they're arguable, really. Like but I don't see myself maybe getting up in Louisiana or North Dakota and doing the same set. That would be a whole other paradigm outside the bubble.
I can't imagine doing the same thing in North Carolina, in North Dakota, where it's cold and dry, and the humor would be drier humor. Then in Louisiana,
humor.
Where it would be swampy humor, fit for alligators, probably.
Yes.
We've come, I mean, think about the distance we've come from, let's say, Lucille Ball to Amy Schumer. There's a lot more permissible these days. Does any of that stuff, do you feel embarrassed or intimidated by any of that, by how straightforward women are about their own sexuality on the comedy stage?
I think it's fabulous. I think I'm just overjoyed that Amy Schumer does what she does. I think it's time, and I think there's certainly a backlash from people kind of, you know, who would say, wow, Eddie Murphy is hilarious, but Amy Schumer is gross. And I think there's still a double standard. I'm glad there are people doing what she does. And I think someone being that far out there who's a woman makes space for other women who are anywhere more prudish to be, you know, she kind of set the bar so high, so far on the blue humor scale that that I can get less blue and people can go, oh, she's not so edgy. So, yeah, I know. I think it's fabulous. It's not, you know, in my last show, I did get pretty graphic, but it's not where I want to reside most of the time. And I just feel like, you know, that sort of thousand flowers blooming kind of philosophy, like we need every kind of woman comedian out there and people of color and, you know, queer people and transgender people. And I think everybody should get to be on the same stage and we all can kind of go, okay, you know, more power to you. That's sort of like, you know, at the end of the, it's not like the Roadrunner, but it's one of those Warner Brothers cartoons where the wolf and the sheep, at the end of their shift, they clock out and they have lunch together and they pour coffee and then they clock back in and then they start chasing each other again. you know, that's how I would want it to be with all of us. That even if we say things that we disagree on, that we can all be on the same stage in the same sphere.
Okay, well, thank you, Alicia Dattner. We'll be back with you a little bit later. Steve Bierman, Wiki Politiki. We're talking about serious comedy in serious times, defying gravity. We'll be back after this break.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, you know your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Bierman, and we're back with Wiki Politiki Segment 2. Our guest is Brian Norell. Brian probably recognizes that music as Drive Your Calm or Curb Your Dogma. He illustrated the CD of the same name back in 2001. I've always found Brian to be an undersung, multi-talented comic genius. He began his career as a star of the cult classic film Dark Star, and he played the character Doolittle. Paradoxically, since that time, he's done lots. He's been a puppeteer for the award-winning children's programs Bingo and Molly and Buster and Me, featured on the Discovery Channel and NBC. And in addition to illustrating numerous books, including my own Swami for President, he's taught cartooning at the Charles Schulz Museum. Brian now has a new book of cartoons. I wish I could show them to you on the radio, called Surviving Trump, The Lion King. And, of course, lion, that's spelled L-Y-I-N. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good. Well, let's start with your latest work, your cartoon book, Surviving Trump. You said it's been a form of catharsis. Tell us more.
Well, I've been cartooning since the age of 8, one way or another. But in terms of political cartoons, I didn't really get into that until Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War provoked me. And that got me going, and then I had a little rest period, and then George W. Bush came along, and that provoked me more. And then Trump came along, and now, you know, I have no pencils left. I just have stubs and erasers everywhere. So it's my way of processing the sort of daily horror that the news lays upon us, and it's my way of psychologically surviving. And that's why I call the book Surviving Trump. Technically, the title of the book is Surviving Trump, Cartoons from Year One. The Lion King is a cartoon on the cover, obviously.
I'm
preparing the print version, which will be out soon, both available through Amazon. And, you know, there'll be more cartoons in there because since last week, there's more cartoons. I mean, how can I stop? I just did one called Sonia's Choice, modeled after Sophie's Choice, where this Hispanic woman is clutching her baby on the border of the U.S. with two monsters galloping toward her, one of them being regional violence and the other one being ICE. And what's she going to do? You know, these are cartoons that are often, you know, funny and not funny at all. I've done a cartoon years ago that I've resurrected again and again, where I have two identical this is cartoons on radio. I like this. My first time. Cartoons on radio. Two identical panels of a little kid huddled under a school desk. And one of them says Cold War and says duck and cover. You know, those of us old enough will remember doing that. The next panel is the identical image, except it just says duck. And there are bullets flying through the air over his desk. I've resurrected that cartoon numerous times for obvious reasons. And every time I resurrect it or put it up online or whatever, you know, it's like it gets less funny by the minute, but it still has its poignancy, you know. So Surviving Trump has been for me up until now. And now that I'm sharing with people, they're saying, oh, I want print copies. I want to buy stuff for my friends. So I'm working on that. But right now, you can go to Amazon and get Surviving Trump cartoons from year one for all of $2.99 through your Kindle app. And you can be reading all these cartoons later this afternoon.
That's very, very easy for people to do. How did you get started in cartooning, by the way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I started drawing gag cartoons probably when I was 8 years old. And I probably because I hit my head. I had a brain concussion. I fell off my bicycle somehow. I don't remember. I have no memory of the event. But I do remember waking up in a hospital and being there for 3 days. And so that whole business about the whack upside of the head kind of thing, it altered me from being pathologically shy to being kind of a class clown. And a class clown who can draw, I think, becomes a cartoonist. And So I just carried on from there. And throughout all my other work, whether it's, you know, screenwriting or acting or whatever it is, the cartooning is always is always going on. And I carry 3x5 cards just in case, you know. So it's always been a survival mechanism. And years ago, I created a comic strip called Crawford Crowe Comics. And I would carry 3x5 cards with me. And anytime I was in a situation where I was pissed off or annoyed or frustrated, I would take out a card and do a comic strip about it. And it was cathartic for me, and the situations were so generic that they're cathartic for everybody else. So I'm hoping that surviving Trump, you know, helps let a little steam out of people's boilers, but not so much steam that you don't have the power to get to the voting booth for the primaries.
No, we definitely want to have that much steam in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Or for what? We definitely want to have at least that much steam in there. You know, one of the things about your cartoons, and again, that's funny talking about them on the radio, kind of like listening to bowling on the radio. It's kind of funny talking about them, is that you add a certain dimension through expression, through nuance, and so on. And when you illustrated the Swami for President, you took ideas that were funny, and just about always add a dimension to it, another dimension to it. Were you always funny? I mean, even when you were littler and you were introverted, were you funny then?
Well, not until I got hit in the head. I was extremely shy and neurotic and unhappy as a little kid until age of 8 when I fell off my bike and I hit my head. And then I was in a new school in a new town. It was very stressful. And some kids were making fun of me because I was so vulnerable. And one of them said, you know, a bunch of them said to me, "Oh, your mother wears combat boots." That was their way of insulting me. And I said, "Yeah, but you should see your driver tank." And they just came undone. You know, they didn't see that coming. And neither did I, really. So that also speaks to my background in improv, because I don't know where this stuff's coming from, but I enjoy it, you know. And anyway, they all cracked up, and then all of a sudden I was okay. You know what I mean? They laid off me, and then I could make them laugh, and then I became, you know, okay. So part of it is a survival mechanism, even as a child, in terms of dealing with bullying, which I had to deal with, and that kind of abuse and put down. So I've always just been using it that way.
Were there anybody who influenced you in cartooning when you were a kid? Did you read Mad Magazine or something like that? Were you inspired or influenced by any other artist?
I certainly did. I did read Mad Magazine. I loved it. And I love the little cartoons in the margin that Sergio Aragonés does, the little one. And years later, he would become a friend, and he is a friend. And I have over my desk, I have a cartoon that I asked him to do for me in 1976. And it's a cartoon of him sitting at his drawing table, pointing down at me with this scowl, yelling at me, going, "Work!" And I can ignore it now, but I've been there for years. And so Sergio has always been an inspiration to me, and it also was a boost to my confidence when I sent him a Crawford Crowe t-shirt that I made specially for him, and he wrote back a card with a funny drawing of Crawford on it, his drawing of Crawford. But his drawing of Crawford wasn't very good, because it's like forging a signature. It's like not quite right, you know? And I realized that the greatest cartoonist in the world can't draw my cartoons. And I used that theme when I first went on my wife's TV show, Buster and Me, on NBC. And I had Buster the Monkey was feeling bad about his own drawings. And I was explaining to him that no one in the world can draw a Buster drawing like he can. And he's the only Buster artist in the world. There's nothing to compare it to. And so I kind of turned his head around during this show, Saturday Morning TV. And for that, I have an Emmy certificate staring me at the wall right here. So I sort of like, you know, carry these lessons over and spread them around elsewhere.
You know, speaking of lessons, I've been I don't want to say disciple, but certainly a follower of Mayor Bobba. You've been a student of Mayor Bobba. Tell us more about that and how that's influenced your life and your perspective on humor.
Well, I'd say there are two things that really altered my life in big ways. One was falling off a bicycle and hitting my head. I don't advise that, but if it happens, you know, take advantage of it. The other is coming into awareness. I never met him, but coming into awareness of Meher Baba after he was gone. But that has been a central part of my life for 40 years now. And he's best known for saying, don't worry, be happy. And that should tell you something right off the bat. But it's also informative to know that he required all his close disciples to have jokes ready to tell at any moment. And he didn't want people around him who were garlic-faced. That's what he called it. And at one point he said, and this is a direct quote, cheerfulness is a spiritual responsibility because it helps others. So, you know, it's not about you, you know. And so being a cartoonist, being a comedian, I haven't seen Alicia's work, but I hope I get to. You know, this is sacred work. And when I started animating and working for Sesame Street for several years, doing animated stories with a little superhero named Thelma Thumb, I stuck a picture of Meher Baba on the camera in the animation room. It's a picture of him with his hands cradling the face of this little boy who's so excited to meet him, his toes are curled up somewhere in India. And it just speaks to the love and the adoration and the mutual love in that moment and that Baba had for everybody, including children, which is such a contrast to what's going on today down on the border, to say the least. So I view my work, whether it's, you know, for Sesame Street or for cartoons or whatever it is, that, you know, in a certain way, I'm doing it for Meher Baba. And what does that mean? To me, it's like a doorway. It's like a doorway that says, I'm doing it for everybody. And I mean everybody. When that business came down in Charlottesville last year, the KKK and the woman got killed, all that happened while I was working on a film in Malaysia. And I was working with a British director, and we were the only two white people there. The rest of the cast and crew were all Chinese, Indians, Malaysians, whatever. And I'm hearing about white supremacy, and I'm looking around going, what? You know? Meher Baba in 1932 in London somewhere, he was interviewed by Paramount Newsreels, and he said, I haven't come to create any new religion or anything like that, but to rather to bring all religions together like beads on one string. And so humor is part and parcel of melting those walls that separate all of us. And I appreciate what Alicia was saying about sacred ground for comedy. And just to comment about women comedians, I've been doing a bunch of extra work. I'm in Screen Actors Guild. And the last movie I worked on recently was a movie called Wine Country, directed by Amy Poehler and produced by Tina Fey. And they're in it along with Maya Rudolph, Rachel Dratch, and all the last generation of funny women and the whole bunch of them from Saturday Night Live. And it was such a privilege just to be in the background while these women just absolutely go nuts. And anyway, I think between that and Amy Poehler, when I think about stand-up comedy, I think back to a show I went to many years ago with Paula Poundstone, and I can still wet my pants thinking about it. There are some funny women out there, and as part of the Me Too movement, I hope that we see more and more, because I think particularly when you get into touchy, taboo subjects, I think when women touch those subjects, it hits a raw nerve, because, oh, you shouldn't say that, you know? So I think it makes comedy better. But also, I understand from my ear to the wall with Pixar and what's going on with Lasseter falling off his throne, that I believe Jennifer Lee is sort of in line to take over Disney Animation down in Pasadena. I mean, Burbank, I mean. Anyway, and then, of course, Kathy Kennedy, who I used to travel around with when I was with Lucasfilm, she has taken over from George Lucas. She's in charge of Lucasfilm, which isn't funny, but it's still poignant. And Kathy's, I really love her. She's really great. So I'm happy about that. But meanwhile, you know, we're in this situation right now with Trump in this country that is just unprecedented. And so we have an unprecedented need for humor. And right now, late night TV, you know, the comedians on late night TV are our main source of real information. And that's kind of pathetic, but at least they're there. You know, I doubt there are that many comedians in North Korea.
Probably not that many working comedians. They may be doing their stuff in mime, perhaps. You know, this is don't say a word. And on the radio, they're doing mime on the radio, probably.
Right.
One of the things that you brought up is that this unprecedented situation, which is more serious than ever before, because there are two different realities. I mean, I get emails from all sites, and you know, there was somebody who's we had what's her name, whose name I won't even mention, was saying, "Oh, those children are just actors," and just this blatant self-deception and so on. That really is unprecedented. You know, when Richard Nixon was impeached or was about to be impeached, you know, there was a certain sense in the country among Democrats and Republicans that the rule of law should be ruling. But somehow in the past 45 years or so, things have devolved to Republicans, and I'm calling them Republicans because that's who's behind, you know, they own Donald Trump right now. So they're in bed, they're married, they're having children together. And so that those people have a different reality. They believe – it's not having different belief systems. It's that they actually believe different facts that may not be facts. Yeah. We'll be back and talk about this serious situation in context of humor with Brian Norell, Alicia Dattner, after this word.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with segment three of Wiki Politiki. We're talking with two funny people, Alicia Dattner and Brian Norell. And so in this last segment, we're all going to join in and look at what do we do? How do we actually create and a movement forward? And what role does comedy and humor play? So whoever wants to jump in, feel free.
I'll start by just saying what a delight to hear you talk, Brian. I mean, so much insight and experience. It's just awesome to hear what you have to share. And I think in general, more people going to see more comedy and participating, going and getting up on stage themselves and speaking and making jokes and enlarging the audience as well as the creators is a really good start.
Well, I'm just impressed because recently I've gone and seen some improv shows, actually three of them, with a group called Three for All. My tongue is tripping
over. They're so good. Three for All.
Yeah.
They're amazing.
I've worked with Stephen Kiernan in the past when I was directing films for a big corporate event in Puerto Rico. We actually took him to Puerto Rico with us and put him in a chameleon suit and put on a zip line over a river in the jungle. It's a long story, and we're not going there. But but watching them, I used to be an improv company called Lucky Dog in Marin. That's years back. And I'm about to probably fall back into getting some improv work because I feel that when I was actively involved with improv theater, that there's this whole practice of not resisting what is. That is very useful in day-to-day life in terms of dealing with conflict. Because there was a guy, I can't think of his name, but he created awareness counseling, quote unquote, and he gave a lecture on conflict. And he said the only two reasons we're ever upset is one of two things. And they're presenting problems, but underlying them, there are two factors. One is something's changing and we don't want it to change. Or we want something to change and it's not changing. Those are the only two things that will cause you to be upset. So it's all about resistance. And improv training and practice is all about not resisting anything. Because whatever is thrown at you from the others on stage, it is you accept it. You take it, you run with it, and you build with it, and you do with it. And right now, it is real easy, and I speak for myself, real easy to listen to what you know, the government has done today and go, no. Mm. You know, and there's a certain need for resistance and pushback and, you know, revolt maybe even, I don't know. But there's also just crippling upset in denying that it is. I mean, it's like, so anyway, I'm just putting a pitch in for everybody getting in an improv workshop because I think it would help the world. It sort of lubricate the world. That's my thought of the moment.
You know, I read something. There's a book that came out last fall that from Yale professor that talked about the differences between conservatives' brains and progressives' brains, and it said that when people are put more into fear, even progressives, they tend to become more conservative. And when conservatives are put more into openness and safety, lo and behold, their beliefs become more progressive. So I'm looking at the potential that particularly improv, which is totally harmless, to where people are having so much fun that they forget to be afraid.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That might be a direction that we go in.
When I'm teaching my workshop, essentially everything about storytelling for me and for my students is creating an environment of safety where people are welcomed and supported at every level, from the limbic level where people feel touch and they feel where we're breathing together, we make sounds together. We make agreements that everything is welcome and accepted, and people are greeted, and, you know, everything about creating a sense of safety when people are beginning to share about their lives in really deep ways has people open and become creative and feel connected like they sometimes never have in their lives.
I can relate to that from my experience as a volunteer facilitator at the Center for Attitudinal Healing. People come into those meetings with the highest degree of stress and trauma that you can imagine. Had, you know, many women have been raped. I had men from My Lai, all kinds of things. And 2 hours later, we're all laughing our asses off. And it's because of the creation of a space of safety and connectedness. And out of that experience, I wrote my book, Living in Vertical Time, because I sensed that within that safety, one could go as deep emotionally into their own fear and express it as necessary. And as a result of having a safe place to do it without being judged and under an atmosphere of unconditional love, then you can go as high up into joy as you can possibly reach too. And it's all this vertical thing that's in contrast to horizontal time, which is, you know, a linear breakdown of time that has the past with its guilt and the future with its anxiety. So when you get into that safe space, whether it's in Alicia's workshop or improv class or a Center for Attitudinal Healing, it's like dough went in and cookies came out, and the heat was love.
Makes me want some cookies.
That's very nice. I think this is leading in a very interesting direction, because one of the things Trudy and I have participated in over the past several months is something called Living Room Conversations, which is we're in a living room. You bring together people from different political points of view. And the first thing that happens is people get to share their stories, who they are. And instead of dehumanizing, which is what so much of our political discourse has become, as dehumanizing, this is rehumanizing. And in a way, whether you're going to end up disagreeing with somebody or agreeing with them, it puts you in a situation where you have to honor and respect who they are, for who they are, for what they've been through. And as we hear one another's stories, and we create these playgrounds on a different playing field, there's the potential for disrupting in a positive way the kinds of distortions that we have with us right now. So Brian, your book here on Donald Trump, have you had any people go, I love Donald Trump and I resent you doing this cartoon book? Have you gotten any feedback like that?
No. I mean, I put it out mainly to my friends, family, social network, you know, people who are probably mostly on the same page. But I am in contact with friends from childhood and high school, going back to third grade. And some of them are sort of militaristic and right wing in a big way. And I went to my 50th reunion, it was a year and a half ago or something, and back in New Jersey. And I was looking forward to seeing some of these people, but politically I was a little nervous about it. And in the middle of dancing in the dark into somebody's backyard to a live band, Jimmy Kavanaugh spotted me, and I thought, oh boy. Oh, I hope. But he ran through the crowd and grabbed and hugged me like he's going to break my ribs, because there's so much love there that it's just nobody ever got into the politics, or we never talked about it. It was just overrun and demolished by the love at the time. So no, I haven't had any negative stuff, but sometimes I do, you know, just because of those old connections who are politically somewhere else. But I'm currently working on some projects in Oklahoma and Texas. I just came back from Oklahoma and Texas recently, and that is very foreign territory. And politically, the stuff I'm hearing shivers my timbers, and I just stay very quiet. but I'm there to try to do something about improving the environment. So I'm going to deal with people on a level that's about improving business by being more environmentally responsible without using the word sustainability or anything that triggers them. So that's a tricky business, but I'm using cartoons to do it, so that helps. So it's always about humor lubricating things.
You know, I think
there's a way in which when we actually connect with each other's personal stories and you get to that place of love, you realize that you can find common ground. And I just love how you're finding, okay, well, we actually are on the same page in this area. And you don't have to use the buzzwords that trigger us and make us upset. We actually can find the places where we're ready to move forward and cooperate and support each other. And I think that's awesome.
Well, there's a good chance I'll start talking like this too. All y'all, you know, get down there and kind of blend in, you know.
I don't know if I can do that.
But I do want to say,
I don't think Alicia. Yeah.
No, I want to just.
I don't think Alicia
to...
can see your teeth that you put in. I don't think she can see those teeth that you put in.
Yeah, I have Billy Bob teeth. They're pretty awful. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
When I was facilitating groups every week for years down at the Center for Attitude and Healing a while ago, you know, all these different kinds of people came in with all this trauma and all this background and all these politics, and we were laughing our asses off 2 hours later. But when I left, kind of like with the improv, the way it affected my view of the world, everybody I see in the supermarket walking past me, I mean, I'm not that aware of it as it was then, I understand they all are carrying these hurts and these fears and this trauma. And
yeah.
God knows what they're going through. And I was just more heart open and empathetic to their suffering, mm-hmm. even if I don't know what it is, than just carrying mm-hmm. around, oh, that guy looks like a Republican. The hell with him, you know. Anyway, those practices are really, really helpful. And whatever they might be for you.
I would even advocate for laughter yoga. You know, when I, about 10 years ago, I came back to the original intention of why I wanted to do comedy in the first place, because I was starting to feel this very tight, constricted feeling. And I just started learning and teaching laughter yoga. And I just taught a workshop last weekend with it. And there's nothing political in laughter yoga. You're basically just laughing for no reason. And you're getting all of the benefits. And if you can get people laughing together, you know, that's another way to get to that place, making a beeline for it. You know, and what you're talking about, Brian. It's just the love.
Well, I know in the dog park when I get knocked over and licked to death, that I'm laughing so hard that a puppy is too heavy. I can't even get up. It's like laughter just takes all your strength away. So if you want to fight somebody, you can't.
Yeah.
You know, Brian, I thought of you a few months ago when friends of ours who have this wonderful golden retriever dog, and they go to Mexico for the winter, and they took their dog down to Mexico. And dogs are not treated very well. And so there's a lot of dogs out in the streets, street dogs, very angry, very scared. They run around in packs and so on. And our friend's dog, I was wondering how was he going to react as when this pack of dogs came up to him. And what he did was he lay down on his back and showed his neck. And this confused the hell out of these other dogs. And they had no idea what to do. And finally, they kind of sniffed him and came over. And our friend's dog actually taught these other dogs to play. They had never played before. And after a period of time, he had them running around and playing in delight and totally forgetting the kind of dogs they had been. So metaphorically, what each of you are doing in your own way through helping people with their solo shows and through helping people laugh through reflecting back the craziness of the world, whether it's through cartooning or through a comedy routine or improv, All of these things are enhancing our ability to play with one another, and it's that playfulness that I suspect will help us overcome and overgrow all of these other toxic forces that have infused themselves right now and are making themselves ready to be healed. So any final ideas about what your new pathway is or what other people might try to do?
Well, I just want to mention, I'm staring at this huge photograph of Mayor Bava over my desk with one of his quotes on it. And the quote is, "Real happiness lies in making others happy." So however you do that, that's your key to happiness. And what does it do? It just spreads happiness. So whether you're giving workshops, doing comedy, doing cartoons, pulling your pants down at the train station, getting arrested, whatever it is, do it.
I love that. I'm gonna piggyback, but with the opposite. Coming from a recovering codependent, for me, real happiness lies in making myself happy. And that ends up spreading joy to other people.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, there we have it. What makes yourself happy, make other people happy. What goes around comes around. Brian Norell, thank you. Alicia Datna, thank you. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. And may the farce be with you.